Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, continuing my conversation with Jerry Dunleavy and James Hassan, the authors of the new book, Kabul, The Untold Stories of Biden's Fiasco and the American Warriors Who Fought to the End. Jerry Dunleavy is helping the investigation of the House Foreign Affairs Committee into the withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021 and after. And James Hassan, former Army captain, graduate of the U.S. Army Ranger School, Bronze Star winner in Afghanistan. James, I'll start with you because I want to do the physical layout of the airport that they had. Military improvises. I understand that. You go to war with the army you got. Okay, so we have Abbey Gate is the important one because that's where the attack will happen on the 26th. There's North Gate, there's East Gate, there's South Gate, and there's Black Gate. All of those gates had to be manned by the arriving Marines and arriving 82nd Airborne. They're arriving not having really good information about what they're going to find. Those gates, what did they look like, James? How did they seal them or keep them so that there was a way, passageway through, but they could defend them? What did they look like?
Yeah, I think it's important first to just give listeners and viewers a quick picture of what the airport as a whole looks like. And I would describe it as like a fat cigar with, just a very kind of long tip at the end, sticking out kind of on the eastern side. And so obviously kind of on that tip was Eastgate, just a little kind of to the west. So if you're looking at the map, kind of to the left was Abbey Gate, where the suicide bombing attack happened. And there was a main entrance to the gate as well, kind of further on the south side. And that basically South Gate. And there was a for lack of a better word, highway kind of leading right up to it. And then on the far northeastern side, you had the North Gate, which was also open. And each of those, kind of conventional gates, because we'll get to the gate the CIA used and other gates that Special Operations Forces used in a second. But each of those gates varied somewhat in terms of what they looked like. I think Abbey Gate is kind of the... that's where the bombing happened. That's where a lot of the evacuations were coming through. And I think that's probably the most important one to describe. And so they had it. Basically, there was a long channel, a long kind of not a road, but kind of like passageway leading up to the gate for a few hundred meters. And at the end of that, where it kind of exits into what's the rest of Kabul proper, the Taliban had set up several moving containers or U.S. forces did to set up those moving containers to prevent car bombs from coming down the avenue of approach. But the Taliban ended up manning all of like that position, so they were sitting on top of them, and in between, kind of right, but running not quite down the middle, but down that path, there was also a sewage canal with all kinds of basically human refuse. And initially, people stayed on one side or the other of that canal running down the avenue of approach. And in the first few days, but they're still swarmed. And once you get to the front, there's kind of an interior holding area that they called the inner gate, which once they let people through, they were vetted, they were searched, the State Department would verify their papers, and then they would get into the airfield itself. but outside, you know, kind of the main gates at Abbey Gate, it was an absolute swarm. Right. I don't know how else to describe it. You had people packed shoulder to shoulder to the point where when Marines jumped in at points or tried to push back and push the crowds back, the compacting was so intense that it pressed their body armor on each side, you know, up against their chest and their back, and made them feel like they're about to suffocate to death. And but the canal itself also filled up, because as people got more desperate, they decided to just jump into literally, you know, human feces. They're packed all the way up to the front. Because it was so frenzied and so chaotic, there were Marines, you know, standing kind of on the wall right outside the outer gate. And they could see below them, too far away for them to get to, babies that got knocked out of their mother's hands and were trampled. They could see, other, you know, women being trampled to death. They also, once people got closer to the gate, where there was, you know, that razor wire, kind of that circular wire that you'd see outside prisons in the United States on the top of the walls, that they had a lot of strings of that right outside the gate and right outside the walls. And women would try to throw their infants over that wire and across the wall in hope that the U.S. Marines on the other side would catch them. And other times when people were getting trampled, like when a mother felt that she was about to get trampled to death, she would hold her baby up and hand it to a Marine standing on the wall, so at least her baby survived. And the Marines also, you know, encountered, you know, women who said that they'd been brutalized by the Taliban. And when those women were told that they didn't have the necessary paperwork to get inside the airfield, some of them would throw themselves on the razor wire trying to kill themselves, so that they didn't have to go back through the Taliban checkpoints.
Jerry, the mob is gathering during the day in that heat without adequate resources, and then it remains into the evening when they close the gate. They're vetting some people through all the time, and this goes back to the SIVs. Who was it that they were letting in those critical days, 16 through 26? Who came in and who didn't come in, and how did they sort that out? And who made the decision? Was state present?
The State Department's guidances on who could get in, who can get out were, who could get in and who wasn't able to get in. Those guidances were shifting constantly. And that was a constant source of frustration for the Marines who were manning the gates. On top of this, there were not nearly enough State Department consular officers on the ground at HKIA to do the job that was necessary to be done. And so there would be many instances where Marines would need a consular officer to check someone's paperwork or to vet people, and there just wouldn't be one available. So these rules were constantly changing. The priorities were supposed to be Americans, legal permanent residents, and allied nation nationals and Afghan SIVs. But the Biden administration had never done a proper job of coming up with a plan about how to get all those SIVs out. On top of that, they sent out, the State Department did, a sort of blank visa form to thousands and thousands of people. And that blank visa form ended up getting airdropped and copied to thousands and thousands of other people. And so one of the main ways that the State Department came up with to help SIVs identify themselves at the airport ended up actually being completely useless when the Marines were trying to identify people. And so not only did the State Department not have a good plan about how to get SIVs out and our Afghan allies out, But then the plan that they came up with on the fly ended up actually hindering the Marines' efforts to identify people in the crowd. And so the State Department completely dropped the ball here. And this is why you had private and veteran-led groups, both in the United States and some of them in Afghanistan proper, coming up with other ways to try to get our Afghan allies to the gates. But it's pretty much the most chaotic situation that you can imagine. As you can see from our book, the Marines and other and the soldiers at the gates did a tremendous job, especially given the impossible situation they were put in. And these outside groups stepped up where the State Department fell down. Kind of the, as we say, sort of the American people at their best, but the American government pretty much at its absolute worst.
Jerry, the director from Washington was always, and their immediate families. What did Washington mean? How did the Afghanistan people interpret that?
Yeah, well, again, this is something that was constantly shifting. Immediate family to Americans generally would mean your children. In Afghanistan, the sense of family is much, much broader than that. And so people were bringing extended family and the like, and that helped to swell the crowds as well. And so there were many, many situations where we had, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of people piled up, and people were having, these Afghans were getting out, even if they themselves were qualified, sometimes their families wouldn't be. And so they would have to make the decision about whether to leave their extended family behind or not. Other times the guidances would shift, and so these massive extended families would be allowed in. Because the guidances were shifting, it constantly meant mass confusion in the crowd, confusion among the Marines about what they were allowed to be doing, and was always contributing to the swelling of these crowds. And because of the swelling of the crowds and the chaos in the crowds, it was obviously a very good opportunity for ISIS-K, which was roaming around the airport, to sneak an attack in.
I'm speaking with Jerry Dunleavy and James Hassan. The book is Kabul. When we come back, the CIA and the NSU and the Taliban all staring at each other. I'm John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Having MG can make cooking difficult, but over the years, I've found some really helpful tools and tips that I'm excited to share. Hi, I'm Alicia. I think cooking should always be fun, creative, and of course, delicious. These black bean burgers are hearty, full of flavor, and MG friendly. You're gonna love them.
Check out Alicia's Black Bean Burger cooking video and other recipes full of tips and tricks for managing common MG symptoms while cooking, only at mg-united.com.
Ready? Let's cook.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.